Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your Owl Post for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, and with me, as she is every single week, the loquacious Dre Kaufman.
You say that only because we've been talking for like almost a half an hour already and been all over the map with what we've been talking about.
And it hasn't had anything to do with our show, really.
Not really. Almost not at all, which is great. And I love it. But yeah, I definitely am having a moment, a little squirrel moment, like squirrel.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll try to get it. I'll get my act together, everyone. I promise. I only make half a promise, but I'll promise you that much. I'll promise you I'll try.
So we got a great email from a listener named Julie who said that she just discovered a podcast a few weeks ago and wanted to tell us how much she's been enjoying it and how much she really appreciates that we really enjoy the story of Harry Potter and seem to enjoy digging into it together through each chapter. She also really likes the fact that it's become part of a routine now for her, she says, to listen to Owl Posts. She listens to a lot of true crime podcasts, and this is kind of a nice palate cleanser for her as she says getting ready for bed or when she can't sleep, and that she's actually already almost done with book 5, which is insane. And it will probably just be repeating episodes once she gets caught up. So she just wanted to thank us for all we do. And so, Julie, we want to thank you for spending time to write us an email, because this is really nice. Like, I don't think you understand what it means for us to be able to get emails like this. It truly makes what we do worth it when we know that people just appreciate it like that. So thank you so much for listening.
Most definitely. Agreed. And you are listening to us like I watch The Office. So I have mad props for the binging ability right there.
It's impressive.
Yeah. And that's awesome. And this is part of what we were kind of on our little tangent about earlier, but we really try to just get in there and think about it in a positive way that allows us to, you know, I feel like we're critical, but not overtly critical. We're not unnecessarily critical of anything. But I like talking about Harry Potter a lot. So I'm glad you like listening to us talk about Harry Potter a lot.
Yeah. Well, and it's important for us to, you know, take the story as it is, right? You know, there we could probably go on a tangents if we wanted about what could have been. But I mean, I'm not an author and I'm not J.K. Rowling, so I can't put myself above her and say, oh, you should have done this. You know, it's her work. And so we're just here to talk about that work that we love. And there may be things that, like, we don't always agree with, but mm-hmm. That's where we'll get into that kind of stuff. So, you know, I just, this has been a joy for me because I've loved, you know, Harry Potter for a long time. And the books mean so much to me just as a story. And, you know, it's just been a joy to be able to walk through them like this. And so.
Well, and I do my best not to wish that things were different than they are in life in general. I don't like to be like, oh, well, I really wish I had a bigger house or a nicer car or a better job. Like, if those are things I want, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find a way to procure them, right? So, but to wish something like Harry Potter was different, I can't change that, right? You can write fan fiction, you can write things that add to the story, you can write the story how you want it, but it's not going to change what got written originally. It's not going to change the stories that J.K. Rowling gives us. So for me, I try not to focus on, oh, I wish this had been done, or I wish this was better. I more say, this was confusing to me, or, you know, sometimes I'll say, I wish I wanted more of that, but not anything to the extent of, I don't want to try to hope that this was something other than it was, because it's never going to happen and I'm just going to be disappointed. So that's kind of a life philosophy I employ, I think, which makes it easier for these kind of discussions, right? So when Matt and I get to talk about it, we get to be excited about it and what's there and not be wishing that it was something else. So I think that helps.
If I wished that this was something else too much anyway, then
it's probably been written and it's probably out there and I can read that instead.
Yeah, but I also probably wouldn't, then I wouldn't really be liking this, like, you know, and I'm talking about it because I like it for the most part. So, yeah, anyway, but thank you so much.
We could go on about this for another half an hour.
We really could. And we already have. We just didn't record it. But thank you so much, Julie. We do just appreciate that you reaching out to us. And if you want to reach out to us, you can. There's many different ways you can do that. If you like us, give us a star rating review on Apple Podcasts. Help other people find the show. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you get the show as soon as it drops. You can find us on Twitter at Join Nerd Party or on Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. Follow, like us on both of those places. Interact with us there too. It's a lot of fun because we, you know, post our shows in both places and we love interacting with everybody there. And then if you wanted to send us an email at thenerdparty.com, there is a contact section where you can do that and you can converse with Drea and I that way. So really excited to be getting into this chapter 17 because we're at a sluggish memory and a lot of important things are going to happen in this chapter because we're going to have another meeting with Dumbledore. But before we get there, it was funny as the kids are leaving the Burrow and they're trying to make Mrs. Weasley feel better, and they are doing a terrible job at it.
They really are. I think she's at the point where nothing they say is really going to make her feel better, but they're trying. I do love her farewell with Harry, though, and Harry's comment of, you know me, I really just want a quiet life. And I think that's a nice reminder, right? Because a lot of times Harry is chasing that theory and chasing down what's right, that we forget that that's not what he wants to be doing, but he's doing it kind of out of obligation for doing the right thing. So it's kind of a nice little reminder before he goes off. And I think it does help her just a little bit. Not a lot.
Yeah. I think it does. You know, and it's funny because, you know, there's the other side of where, you know, her kids are trying to kind of make her feel better and they're not doing a great job at it because there's also the sibling rivalry that goes along with all of that, you know, and the
discord that's with Percy now.
Yep.
And that they didn't really make that any better. They sort of called him out while he was there.
I mean, he's kind of a prat.
Yeah. We get the other side of what happened while Harry and the minister were talking, right? And we find out that all three of the kids take credit for throwing, what is it, parsnips?
Yeah.
mashed parsnips. It's really hard for me to say for some reason. At Percy and him kind of storming off angrily. And none of them feel bad about it, right? They all want to own the fact that they're calling him out as he is, and that is not helping Mrs. Weasley at all with what's going on. So, I mean, that doesn't really add to her discomfort of them leaving to go back to Hogwarts.
Yeah, it doesn't. And you know, they get back to Hogwarts, and what was interesting here is because of the security measures, the kids are not traveling back on the train. They're actually just going by flu powder. And the school has specifically opened this up with the ministry to make sure that all the children can get back to school safely, easily, and very quickly. And so they travel by flu powder and they get into McGonagall's office and all of them arrive safely and they get back and they're trying to get into the common room, which is really funny because they use the normal the same password that they had when they left. And she's like, well, that's not the password. And like, well, we were gone. And so Hermione comes running up and gives the password, which is abstinence.
But don't think of it. The funny thing is they go on immediately to explain that it's not the way we think of it, like here in the US. It's that the fat lady drank way too much wine over the break and made herself sick. And now she's abstaining from alcohol. So I thought that was really funny. And for kids who don't understand, it's like eating a gallon of ice cream and getting really sick and then being like, I'm never eating ice cream again in my life. Right. So I thought it was really, really funny. And that character is just, it's such a ridiculous, like, it's not even a tertiary character. It's like even further out there than that. Having like just giving her a little bit of life outside of just being the portrait hole lady who kind of harasses them a little bit. Right. And then it all sort of very quickly dissolves right back into the same dynamic that existed before they left for Christmas, which Harry is super disappointed about.
Yeah. He gets a note from Hermione saying that he has a meeting with Dumbledore the next day. And then, like you said, Lavender Brown shows up and, you know, takes Wan Wan away. And Hermione's not having any of that. And Harry is like, can you just let it? And she's like, no. She's adamant to the point of like, it kind of feels like she wants to slap him if he keeps talking about it anymore. So Harry just lets that go so they can have a conversation about all the things that Harry hasn't been able to talk to her about. One of them being all the things that happened at the Burrow, especially, you know, talking to Ron's dad and Lupin about the whole Malfoy situation, which was really interesting. And this is where Hermione reminds us that we've heard about Fenrir Greyback before.
Yeah. And even before we get to that, I think this is kind of the one conversation where Harry gets, I don't want to say a win, but he gets a little bit of validation for his theory, right? Because while she comes up with the same excuse that everybody else did, basically he goes, but you have to admit that that means Malfoy's up to something, right? He gets at least that much, right? He gets this little bit of an eek ahead in his theory that Malfoy is up to no good. And that's, I think, worth calling out because as we see in the rest of this chapter and in the last chapter, he keeps getting shut down on this focus that Malfoy's up to no good and that Snape is with him, because everyone kind of redirects back to Snape and leaves off Malfoy. And this is kind of the first time where he gets someone to admit that, okay, maybe Malfoy is up to no good here. And maybe you're right about Malfoy, right? He gets a little bit of a win. And I think that helps him feel a little bit better. And I think Hermione knows that.
Well, and that was interesting, too, because tied into the fact that they've heard about Greyback, this is one of the reasons that Harry is able to kind of score some of these points, because they remember then that it was Malfoy threatening Borgin with Greyback coming against his family. Right. And so Harry's able to say, well, he's got to be involved with the Death Eaters. How else would he be able to do this? If he wasn't in league with Death Eaters. So I just think that's really fascinating. And that's one of those ways where, like, Harry's able to, again, use some really good logic here to kind of support his theory as he's been building this case against Malfoy this whole book. And like you said, the fact that Hermione's like, yeah, I mean, you got a point. I can't explain that one away. It definitely makes him feel better. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, his point of, well, you know, we know Greyback, he's kind of got this like logic puzzle you do in like grade school. Well, if Greyback is a Death Eater and Malfoy associates with Greyback, does that make Malfoy a Death Eater? Right. And he sort of, for him, the logical conclusion is, well, yeah. Hermione doesn't really validate one way or the other. But I think that's enough logical validation for him that he's good with it. He's just excited to go meet with Dumbledore and share this with him as well.
Well, and this is something that's interesting too, because we get the announcement that they're going to have the apparition lessons that are going to be starting soon. And the cost for those is actually 12 galleons. So this isn't a part of school. This is something you have to pay for if you want to do. And it's an interesting conversation between Harry and Ron, which kind of makes Harry really popular at school. The fact that he reminds him that he's apparated before with Dumbledore, and he didn't really like the feeling of it, honestly. And they can't take the test till they're 17 so that they can actually apparate. And for Harry, of course, that's not going to be till July. And so it'll be quite a while anyway. Well, Ron's really excited of this because for him, it's March. So I love that kind of it slips out to everyone that Harry's apparated before, and like everybody in school is coming to him trying to ask him what it's like to apparate, and I'm sure it kind of is annoying to him, and
again, once in the spotlight, when that's like the only thing in the world he doesn't want, and it's again Ron casting that spotlight because that's what Ron would want, right? Like, so that's him trying to do the right thing by Harry, but not really having enough self-awareness to know that's not really what Harry wants, even if that's what Ron wants. And I feel like that's relatable. We've all been there, right? we do something we think is kind because we'd want someone to do it for us, and it's the opposite of what they want. So I think it's another learning lesson that we go through at that age, and it reminds you how old they are. So there's little tips in here about they're just teenagers making out on couches in their common room.
And, awkward.
But yeah. Sorry, total side note there. Again, I got to focus here.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was happening earlier, so goodness, Ron is, whew. Anyway, luckily.
Lavender is also whew.
Yeah, goodness. We get Harry going to his meeting with Dumbledore, and I love their conversation. It is very interesting. One of the things that they talk about is the fact that, you know, Harry met the minister for the first time. And that, of course, that he was not very happy with Harry. And Dumbledore says, well, yeah, he's not very happy with me, but we've got to kind of battle on. And they both kind of grin at each other. And
I do really like,
out,
though, that he takes it as an opportunity to take a stab at the paper as well. Mm-hmm. The Daily Prophet here, because he's like, oh, so that's what you guys were arguing about when they reported that in the newspaper. And he's like, yep, even if they don't know all the facts, every once in a while they're correct. So I thought that was pretty funny, too, because we talk a lot about how she really rips on the media in these books. And here's just another little sly, like, stab as we go through.
Well, and it's really interesting because we learn that this is the idea that Scrimgeour has about, you know, using Harry is something that Fudge had originally.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry just like was like, why would he think I would want to help him after all the things that he did to me after Umbridge? It makes no sense. And, you know, Dumbledore just agrees, and he tells, you know, Dumbledore that, you know, the minister accused him of being Dumbledore's man through and through. And I love Dumbledore's response. How very rude of him.
Well, I like at first how he's kind of like trying to take it as an insult, right? And then Harry's like, I told him, yeah, I am. And it really touches Dumbledore because I think we'll come to learn a lot about Dumbledore and why that might be so touching for him. But right now, for what we know of him, it's not really in his character to accept the flattery that goes around. No one ever kind of directly gives that flattery. Everything's kind of, he's almost like legend. You talk about him and not to him, right? This is kind of the first time someone's pledging that in a very open and honest way to him. And I think it's honestly flattering, especially knowing what they've been through, right? And how rocky that relationship's been. So,
well, and this is it's a really cool moment because Dumbledore kind of like goes to speak after Harry said that, and then kind of just closes his mouth, and then Fox, the Phoenix, lets out this just gorgeous, beautiful musical cry, and Harry can actually realizes that Dumbledore seems to be kind of somewhat taken aback and emotional, like that his eyes seem to be rather watery, you know? And so there's this very touching moment between them, but it also, it leads into a contentious moment as Harry tells him everything about Snape and Malfoy. And it doesn't obviously go the way that Harry wants it to. And part of that is Dumbledore saying, look, everything you've told me, I really appreciate you telling me, but it's nothing that surprises me. And I'm glad that you have, you know, confessed this, but I have extraordinary brain power, he says. And I've understood everything you've told me, because Harry kind of is like, are you not understanding what I'm saying? So it's just, there's this moment between them, and I love the way that Dumbledore explains it, how he says how, you know, often happens, even to the best of friends, that each of us believes that what we have to say is more important than the other, but we kind of have to move on. And I thought that was really an interesting place for Dumbledore to get, because he acknowledges again that Harry obviously does not agree with Dumbledore, but that they have to find a way to move on because what they're about to talk about is slightly more important.
Yeah. I also got I get the impression, and I might be reading too much into this, and that's fine, that word of what Harry is telling Dumbledore has already made it back to Dumbledore. And he's already had, it has an edge of impatience to me that says he's already had to talk about this a couple times. He is frustrated. He's already having to defend Snape again to Harry. But I get the impression that this is something maybe like asked and answered in another situation. And it does kind of, I think he handles it fairly calmly, but I also think this is a little bit of humanity coming through in him, and that, again, he doesn't listen to what Harry is saying, and he's not hearing what he needs. He's listening to respond, right? He's not listening to what Harry is saying and giving him any sort of validation. He kind of brushes over like, oh, it's a good thing you told me, but it's similar to what the other adults said, that they weren't making Harry feel heard. And I think it's, again, a little of that adult student mentality, but I also think I think he's having a hard time convincing Harry to believe him in certain situations, and he has a really easy time in others, and I think that frustrates him. Like, it frustrates Dumbledore, right? Like, he can convince Harry that this is important, that they need to learn all about these memories they're looking at, but he cannot convince Harry that Snape is on their side. No matter right. what he does, no matter how hard he tries, he's always fighting that battle. And I think he's just kind of tired of it. So he's kind of impatient when those topics
yeah.
come up.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, he says that he's tolerated that question enough already from Harry about Snape, and he's not going to tolerate it anymore.
Well, and so I think why I read into it, like others having brought this up, is he says he's answered that question enough already. He doesn't specify to Harry. So right. my guess is he's had to answer that question to others a lot. And he's just kind of done with that question in general. And Harry's just the last person to ask him that question. So,
yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think this is one of those places, too, where Dumbledore rightly calls out saying, you know, this is what happens between friends. We both believe that we have the more important thing to say than what the other has to contribute. And Harry does admit, like, I don't think what you're going to say is unimportant. Mm-hmm. And so that enables them to shift.
Move on past this conversation.
Yes, into this next section where we're going to talk about these memories. And before we dive into the next memory, though, we actually have just kind of a conversation about where we left Tom Riddle and him coming to school, and
I feel like it's a last time on moment.
Yeah.
Last time on Harry Potter.
But it's also important because we're actually we get some of Dumbledore's musings about, you know, Riddle at school, mm-hmm. and the fact that, you know, the other professors and other students kind of seem to like him immediately. You know, his situation kind of gave him the ability to engender sympathy for him. And Dumbledore, instead of kind of telling other professors about what he experienced with Tom Riddle, he gave him, you know, the opportunity to have a chance. And
it's
in
here,
this,
though, we also get kind of a flashback to book two, mm-hmm. When Harry, Dumbledore says something to the effect of, you know, I gave him the benefit of the doubt to grow and change, right? Which is something that, you know, you and I were talking about, that he kept a closeful eye on him, but allowed him an opportunity to become a different person, given different circumstances. And Harry aptly remembers from several years ago that when the memory of Tom Riddle comes out of the diary, that he says that Dumbledore never trusted him very much. He always kept a watchful eye on him, and he never liked him as much as the other teachers liked him. And Harry brings that up, and Dumbledore's like, very good memory, you know, and elaborates that, yeah, while he was giving him an opportunity to be a better person, that doesn't mean that he blindly trusted him.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because Dumbledore is able to elaborate about his life at Hogwarts and how he kind of has basically these forerunners of the Death Eaters around him, people who are either looking for power or looking for people to protect them from the more powerful And that they, you know, have all of these kind of things that kind of happen around this group, but they're never able to really pin on them that it actually was them. The most, you know, blatant of all of those being what you called out with the Chamber of Secrets being opened and, of course, Hagrid being wrongly accused of that crime. And this predilection in Riddle to be obsessed about his parentage and being frustrated, obviously, finding out that his father was definitely not the wizard, that it was his mother, and that really bothered him, of course, because she died and he couldn't understand that. And that he dumps the name Riddle, and all he has to go on to search for his mother's side of the family is Marvolo. And the memory we see then is from his uncle's perspective of when Riddle comes in his 16th year at Hogwarts to confront his uncle. He doesn't really know he's going to be there, but he goes to the old house, and it turns out his uncle is the only one left.
Yeah, and before we dive into that memory, I do really love how we really get an outline of the three groups that are attracted to Voldemort, right? You have those who are weak and seek protection from those who are stronger. You have those who are fearful to stand up to him. And then you have those mm-hmm. who are capitalizing on the level of cruelty he brings and want to be a part of that cruelty, right? So it kind of breaks that segment into three unique people. And I think we have some really good examples of followers we've already met that fall in each of those three categories. So, I mean, I think we have Greyback, who falls into the cruelty category, right? He is learning what he knows what Lord Voldemort can do to increase his power and his cruelty. You've got someone like Malfoy or some of those followers that talk about, okay, well, he's powerful and I don't really want to cross him and I get a lot of power and I get a lot out of this relationship. And then you've got someone who's kind of like Wormtail, who's just terrified and wants the protection and the power that comes from being in his good graces. So I think it's interesting that we've already kind of seen these three categories play out, but that they're very nicely summed up. And that's part of why he rose to power so quickly, is that's majority of people, right? Like that's that's majority of the wizarding population. Otherwise that, or you're staunchly against him and you put a target on yourself, right? You can't really hide. So I thought that was so interesting how he summarized that started while he was at school. And really shows how deep and entrenched that goes and how strong his charm really is, that he can charm his way into all of that.
Yeah, it's definitely a little scary. And I think obviously it represents what we see in real life, right? Of, you know, evil dictators and people like that being able, or cult leaders, you know, things like that. You think of, like, I was just watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and, you know, obviously that deals with the Manson family and their, you know, attempt on Sharon Tate's life and everything. So, you know, just these type of people that aren't able to attract others to them, which, you know, when you look on from the outside, honestly, you're kind of like shocked by when you see what they do, but that other people are, they want to be a part of these type of things. So I just think it's really interesting. And
that she kind of nailed that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. She writes this, I think, perfectly with the character of Voldemort. And so it's
so
really,
then we dive into his uncle's memory, mm-hmm. kind of knowing all of that, right?
Yep.
And knowing that ever since we've known him, he has this like unbridled emotional rage that he almost can't control. His reaction to, right? And then we go into this memory from his uncle, and we find out that he tells Voldemort who his human or his muggle side of the family is, and tells him where they are, and gives him this whole fantasy about how he stole his mom and they ran away, and then he had the gall to leave her and all this stuff, which from our own understanding of the story is not necessarily the correct perspective, but it's definitely how the family feels about what happened.
Yeah. Well, and it's just interesting because it makes you wonder then, is this the kind of first understanding that Voldemort has of what happened with his mother? Which I think is really interesting, and obviously gives him an awful perspective of what she had done. But
based on his reaction, you think it's, even if he knew the other one, this is the one he believes.
Yeah.
Or he chooses 100%. To believe. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and we see too that, you know, he then learns about the fact that she had taken this locket as well, the Slytherin's locket, with her. And then, of course, that had been lost. And
I think he said that the dad stole it or took it from her. It was something that was almost a direct impact on, like, the dad did something with it. He took her away and he took that too. Like, it was very much so, like, painting the disrespectful treatment of that locket, right?
Yeah.
Which we know from the previous memory she sold to feed Voldemort. Yeah.
Well, and this is also one of the places where we see this mystery for Muggles, but that we know magic answers, which is, the Muggles.
Yeah, he says he robbed them. He says that Tom Riddle Sr. robbed them of the locket. Mm.
Yeah, which makes sense then why we see Voldemort go and kill them with Morphin's wand, and then through a very, tricky bit of magic, and plants the memory of him killing them in Morphin, so that when the authorities find Morphin, he confesses to what he thinks he did and is very happy about what he did. But we also see that Dumbledore was able to figure this out through a lot of legilimens and occlumency work, which is incredible. And the heart of Dumbledore, too, of he presents this information to the Ministry of Magic to try and get Morphin released, because he did not do this. And unfortunately, Morphin dies before he can be released. So we really have this whole situation we see of this really unrepentant, evil heart already at work in, Voldemort at the age of 16. Like, this is... Well,
and the talent, right? We were talking about how this is a difficult and challenging thing to do, and how if no one had thought that it's not even anything that, like, would have easily been detected or anything like that. It's just an incredibly skilled piece of magic he's able to do at a very young age. So now we have this, like, unbridled cruelty and this supernatural ability that are coming together that make it even more of a terrifying situation to find yourself in. And I love both the heart that Dumbledore brings to this to try to save Morphin, even though we've kind of determined he's a terrible person, right? Super racist, but in his mind, it doesn't matter. He doesn't deserve to serve punishment for something he didn't do, which he straight up says. But then how angry Harry stays about what happened after. He's just, it even comments that he's, like, really put off by the injustice of the whole situation. That's what he takes away. Not that someone died, but that the injustice of the situation. So it's pretty crazy. But it also explains a big piece of sort of magical law that we were missing, or an explanation of how magical law, like a big flaw in the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's because, Harry asked the question about, like, what about underage magic? Shouldn't they have known that this happened? And that when underage magic happens, they can't detect who it has been done by. They can just detect that it has been done.
They can say where it is, and then the rest of it is sort of process of elimination. Mm-hmm. And he uses the example in the second book about Dobby casting a spell at the house, but no one knowing Dobby's there. And in their mind, the only wizard there, only magical creature there was Harry. So it had to be Harry.
Which is just, I mean, it's really interesting. And this is also where they talk about the idea that, you know, you would normally, you would lean on parents to tell the truth about what had happened in the situation. And so since that, there was nobody to lean on that here, and you had somebody just confess to the murder, you know, the authorities there at the ministry, they take it at face value what they get. And you can honestly see why they would do so. I mean, you know, there's no reason for them not to believe that Morfin did what he said he did, you know? So I think, yeah, again, you do. I like where you, how you kind of point out. You kind of see Harry, the beauty of Harry, and the fact that he is truly somebody who cares about right and wrong, and this idea of, like, you know, that Harry would be upset at something like this because of what you mentioned, which is that it's unjust. Like, it's not right for Morfin to have suffered for something like this when he had nothing to do with this. It was all Voldemort. And again, I think this just kind of shows us how smart Voldemort is in planning all of this to get away with it, right? Like, that's genius. I mean, it's evil genius, but it's still genius.
Oh, yeah. It's also interesting because this is not the first that we hear about the Riddle family dying. It's actually brought up before this point. I'm trying to remember which section, but this is not the first time we hear that the Riddles have died, right? And it's this, like, mysterious death. I believe it was, I'm trying to remember what book.
It was in the fourth book.
Yeah, the fourth book, they talk about how there was some mysterious death of this wealthy family in the country, and how nobody knew what it, you know, who'd done it and things like that, or how the muggles didn't know how they had died. It was some kind of reference to this that was very vague back in the fourth book that we're now in the sixth book circling back to and giving an explanation and more context to why we were provided that. And I love when she does that. I love when something happened several books ago that is significant and you just need to pay attention and you just need to, like, kind of ingest it. And this is, you know, such a tragic story, but I like how she plays it.
Yes. Well, and it's interesting too, because the next memory that we're going to see is the memory with Slughorn, which has been altered. And I think the most interesting thing for me is not the fact that the memory has been altered, although obviously that's going to be the thing that Harry will then have to try to overcome with Slughorn. But I think the thing that we see here is just how good Tom is at buttering people up and getting what he wants. The fact that, you know, he asks about the fact that Professor Merrythought is retiring, and Slughorn talking about how he has no idea how Tom is able to know these things. But we also see him thanking Tom for bringing him pineapple, and that is his favorite. And so that Tom is a genius when it comes to making people comfortable with him so that he can then use them for his own benefit. And he does that clearly here with what he's trying to get out of Slughorn, which has something to do with these things called Horcruxes.
It's interesting because this is the smallest part of the chapter, but it's definitely where the namesake of the chapter comes from, which kind of tells you the significance of it above all else. I mean, what we've learned is super important up till now, but honestly, it doesn't really change anything in the future, right? Everything we've heard so far until we get to the Slughorn memory they're all history that's good to know and historical, but they're not anything that he can really affect in the future, or nothing that really lends itself too much to the future. Kind of besides the one nod that we get where he ties the two memories together, in that one of the things that Morfin was obsessed with was the loss of the ring. He didn't really care about the fact that he was thrown in jail, but he lost this ring. And as we enter Slughorn's memory, we see the ring on Tom's hand. So it also gives us context in that I think Harry even calls it out. Okay, he's already killed his family. He's right. already killed his dad. That's where we're at, right? And so as we launch into this memory, Harry starts to notice that there's some weird things about how mm-hmm. it plays out. And as readers, especially first time through, or if you've never seen the movie, you kind of have no idea what's going on, but it does feel weird and clunky. Like it doesn't quite fit right.
Well, and this is where after the memory, it's so important because Dumbledore says that, you know, Slughorn has tampered with his own memory. You know, he has tried to obliviate certain portions of it and obviously badly.
Uh-huh.
But that it's only going to be through Slughorn giving somebody the memory willingly that we would be able to see what this memory entails. And so the homework that Harry has is to get Slughorn to give him this memory, because Dumbledore says it's not going to come by force. It's not going to come through, you know, a trickery. It's going to come through him giving it willingly. And there's no way I can do that. I already tried. It didn't work. And so it's going to need to be you. And what's interesting is we end the chapter with Phineas, one of the portraits, saying, "I can't see why the boy should be able to do it better than you." And Dumbledore saying, "Why? I wouldn't expect you to." And then Fox gives out another musical cry. And so it's just really interesting the way that this chapter kind of gives us this sense of something really important has just happened. And it's been accentuated by Fox, who the last time he cried in this chapter was because there was somebody giving Dumbledore loyalty. And here it's interesting because Dumbledore is giving Harry loyalty.
It's really interesting because we're also introduced to something that becomes so vitally important to the rest of the series. And it's this concept that we don't even know what it is yet. It's just this word mentioned of a Horcrux. And we have no idea what it means or what it is. And surprisingly, Harry doesn't really ask. They focus very much so on just getting the memory from Slughorn. And I feel like there's this unspoken rule that once he gets that memory, Harry's question of what that is will be answered. But yeah, it's this kind of beautiful moment. And I think it's interesting too, because it's one of the few moments we get that's not at the start of a book where Harry is not present for what just happened. Right, because most of this book, once we launch into Harry's perspective, is all from Harry's perspective. It's all mm-hmm. what he sees and hears and experiences. It's what's happening around him. This is kind of the first time, right in the middle of a book, the moment happens after he leaves, which I think is also adding to its significance and the beauty of this moment, too, that it's so important to have Dumbledore's loyalty to Harry called out as significantly as Harry's loyalty to Dumbledore. And then I also think it does really speak just to some people's inability to see someone's potential, right? We all like to think we've had that mentor or a teacher or adult who's really helped us become more than we are, who saw us things in us that we didn't see in ourselves. And I feel like that's a little bit of what's happening here, is that Dumbledore sees that potential in Harry that others, like the portrait, can't see. And it is just a touching moment for sure. It's a good way to end the book. It's kind of a beautiful, sorrowful moment almost, especially because what the task he was just given very quickly is going to be a challenge. It's hard. We already know it's going to be hard.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too. I wonder if, on the Horcrux thing, where you're thinking maybe Harry doesn't necessarily realize just its importance because of the fact that there's so many other things for him and Dumbledore to talk about at that moment, which is what's going on with this memory and why is it important for me to get this memory from, like, you know? And so it's almost as if it just kind of gets passed over because Harry hasn't had really any time to process all this in the first place, you know? Yeah. So that random mention, while something that looks to be important coming up in the future, it is important. But, you know, I just wonder if he isn't able to think of even asking that because there's other things to ask about that are a little bit more pressing in his mind at this moment.
Well, and I think sometimes he gets... I think that sometimes his questions, he overlooks the super obvious questions.
Yeah,
and
sometimes.
Goes too far, right? And so he assumes that... And he, I think also it's his lack of being immersed in the wizard culture, which, I mean, we're 6 books in, so he's 6 years into the culture, but he assumes other people know what these things are beyond him. So he'll go ask someone he trusts, like Hermione or Ron, what they are. And when nobody knows, that's when he'll start going up the chain, mm-hmm. if you will, right? He assumes he should probably already know what that is versus asking, I think. He kind of got comfortable with that. So, you know, I think that's a little bit of what happens here too. But yeah, he's left with this incredibly challenging task that is daunting enough that Dumbledore is not even able to complete it, and he has to try a different tactic. And I think this is the moment too where it kind of clicks for Harry why he was brought to solicit Slughorn and why he's back and why he's been encouraged to spend time with him. And I think all those pieces are coming together for him now, and he knows that that's the important focus right now.
Yeah, I think there's a pivot point in the book now, because there's another layer to things that are happening. And again, it, like you said, it's a place where things are starting to slowly come together. Like why we did in the first book, what we're going to do, you know, why we did at the beginning of the book, you know, all those things that we're working on now are starting to slowly come together and pay off, and see where they're all going to fit together in the puzzle. So can't wait to be able to get to that. But Dre, if anybody wants to catch up with you and talk to you before we come back next week and talk about the next chapter, where can they find you?
Sure, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and that's Kaufman.
Well, and you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero under the name MattRushing02. I am here on the network doing Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. You can also find me over on the Trek FM network. I do 2 shows. One's called The Orb with Chris Jones. We talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And then you can also find me doing the 602 Club, which is our general geek show. And we just talk about all of the fandoms that we love. So there's so much happening and within geekdom. And we're talking about something each and every week there. And then last but not least, doing Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney. And we're talking about films through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.